Okay, continuing this morning, the workbook, if you got the workbook, we're on pages 18 and 19, looking at the text of Mark chapter 9, 33 through 37, and chapter 10, 35 and 45 as some example texts as the looking at the servant side of Jesus and Jesus teaching his disciples in these cases what is true greatness, and true greatness is not as the world often thinks of it, but in fact, say seldom thinks of greatness in this way, where humility and service is the key to greatness, and humility is not upheld in society today. Anytime you turn on the TV or hearing the news or anything, it's the ones that are loud and arrogant and boastful, the ones that get all the attention. And those are the ones that are the models for our children, unfortunately. And they're going to learn whatever they see. And that's why it's important for us as parents and people that they know to be the example. And so they can see some real life examples of what we are supposed to believe. And we got down to number three on the questions on page 19. When we look at the reaction of the disciples, when Jesus asked them what they had disputed, what was it that caused them to keep silent?
He knew what they were thinking.
Okay. And so what were they thinking? What were they discussing?
Who would be the
greatest? And imagine, put yourself in their shoes. Here you are talking about greatness, and then he asks you, what were you talking about? To me, this is kind of like the case of the adulterous woman when they were ready to stone her to death and brought her to Jesus to ask what he would do. And his response was, he who is without sin cast the first stone. What happened to the accusers then? You know, slowly left because they were, what? They were convicted by their conscience. I think that's kind of what we're seeing here. They're convicted by their conscience. I think they knew that that was not a discussion that they needed to be having. When you start talking about who's the greatest and put yourself in the context, am I going to be that great one, then something's already not right in the discussion there. Again, think about the context here. These men are walking with whom? Son of God. Should they be talking about who's the greatest? Shouldn't we know who the greatest is? And that's part of the problem there. Anytime we're talking about the question of who's the greatest and we're putting ourselves in the discussion, we've got it mixed up. You know, they should have seen, and I think they did know, but we get caught up in ourselves too much sometimes.
I was reading about, and I don't want to go too much into this, but the San Antonio Spurs, one of the most successful NBA franchises, and known for their culture, and they were talking about how they look for the right players for the organization. And the first thing that they listed was people who have gotten over themselves.
Yep.
And if you know the culture in the NBA, it's a lot about me and I and what I've accomplished. But if you look at them, and there's so many applications for this, you know, in the corporate world, looking for team players,
right,
looking for people who aren't in about just what they're trying to accomplish, but looking for the good of the whole.
You know, it makes a difference, as you said, whether it's the NBA or out in the corporate world or wherever it may be. Big difference between someone who's there working with others to make a name for themselves and someone who's working there to help get accomplished what needs to get accomplished. Big difference.
I think it could point to that there's still misunderstanding the meaning of kingdom. I mean, at this point, if there's spiritual maturity, I don't think they're bragging about who's going to convert the most souls,
right,
who's going to be the best preacher. You know, so I still think that they're buying, I'm going to be a general, I'm going to be a colonel. You know, so
I agree, because these things kind of go hand in hand. When you've got a materialistic outlook, like the material physical kingdom, you're going to be thinking a lot differently than someone who's thinking about a spiritual kingdom. Spiritual kingdom, you're going to be thinking about spiritual things and spiritual successes and spiritual victories. And it's not going to be about self and your position or your place. And it's easy to fall into that, though. And I can tell you as a preacher, it's real easy to fall into that. Because as soon as you start having a lot of people that build you up, it's easy to get a big head and think that you're more important than somebody else. Every once in a while, you need somebody to bring you back down to where you're really at. Yeah, anything else on that?
You think they were embarrassed?
Oh, yes. Yeah, rightly so. You know, I think we probably all had occasion to that, where you come in on a discussion where everybody all of a sudden gets quiet when you walk in the room. You know that they're talking about something they shouldn't have been talking about. Maybe you. And what's she talking about? Oh, nothing. Well, it's because they don't want you to know what they've been talking about. And same thing here. Problem was, he already knew what they were talking about. And so, yes, I think they were embarrassed, and rightly so. When he told them later it was not his to grant positions when they were asking for one to sit on the right and one on the left, he says it's not his place, but it's for those to whom it is prepared. So why were they then upset with James and John? I think they were thinking he was talking about them, because he didn't say no, that you can't have this. And in effect, it was to them, I think it was a non-answer, not a refutation, I guess you could say, that they were not going to have those places. But again, the attitude here of all of them, not just for James and John asking for these positions, but the rest of them, when they heard the answer of Jesus, verse 41, they began to be greatly displeased with James and John. They didn't have the right attitude either. Because they were still, even though James and John were the ones that were saying it, sounds to me like all of them were really wanting some recognition or higher place. And as we talked about last week, within the Lord's church, that should be the last place where we see any division or separation or classification. You know, out in society, how many different ways can man come up a way to divide himself or categorize himself? Race, education, what country you come from, how much money you make. I mean, how many different ways does man find a way to draw lines of distinction? Probably coming up with a new one every day, right? But in the Lord's church, it shouldn't be that way. And that's part of the problem with wanting some higher position. Who's got the only high position in the church?
The Lord.
Yeah, Colossians 1:18. God made him to be head over all things to the church, that in it he may have the preeminence. Preeminence means the high spot, high place. Only one. Everybody else, we're all supposed to be on the same level. Yeah, and what was worse, they used their spiritual gifts that had been given to them to make those distinctions. Yeah, I agree. That was the problem. They were fractured. You know, here's a body, as the picture that he tries to paint for them is what the church is supposed to be, a body. Supposed to be working together. They were finding ways to divide themselves. And Paul was very severe in his chastisement. I do not praise you for this, he said. Richard?
Well, there in the First Corinthians book 1, they were just trying to make a distinction of who baptized.
Right.
And of course, Paul said, I didn't baptize any of you except Christians and Jesus.
Yep.
Lest you think that you were baptized in my name.
You know, if you go through that first letter, you just note all the ways they found ways to divide themselves. It's pretty sad how fractured and divisive that they were. Question 4, how did or how would Jesus exemplify the attitude of humility in his life? And this attitude being what he demanded of his disciples? How did he show it in his life? By serving, right? Going out and doing it. So what are some specifics? What are some specific things that he did to show that attitude of service? Foot washing, John 13, sure.
Just by being accessible to all the people.
Okay. Okay. And all the people who were brought to him to heal their sicknesses, and this is the odd thing, the unique thing about it, is that he showed his humility in healing all of them, setting aside himself and taking care of their needs, but at the same time, what kind of power did it take to heal all those sicknesses? So you've got the servant part of Jesus and the master at the same time. Okay, anything else, Luis? And I think his question to them, are you going to drink the same cup that I'm going to drink, went to that very point. You really understand what you're asking for? And that is a question we need to ask ourselves, really, before we even commit to serving Christ, is it not? Are you really ready to serve him all your life? Years ago, when I was over in China teaching over there, right before I went over there, we had a report that a different part of the country, there had been a raid on one of the brethren's house, and they were asking for all the names of members of the church because they saw it as something treacherous, for lack of a better term. So we knew that the atmosphere wasn't exactly great for anybody who professed faith and openly. And so the ones that we taught, we told them, you know, before you make your decision, you need to know what's happening in your own country. Are you ready to face with what might happen to you? And when I told some people that when I came back, they were upset at me for telling them what they might have to face because I might scare some off. Well, am I wrong? I think we need to know exactly what we're getting into. And for them, it's a little bit different from you and I. We don't face those same persecutions. I thought it was necessary that they know that. Because if they weren't ready for that, they would be given up.
If they hadn't been told, they'd been scared off anyway.
Probably. That's my thinking. I would rather prepare them to know the possibilities, the reality for them of what could happen. And so when the day came, they wouldn't be surprised. They would at least have an opportunity to build up their courage and their faith. That's what I think.
Yeah. Talk is cheap. It's the living that's
going to cost. And again, going back to what Louise was saying, that they didn't really understand what they were asking for in this, in asking to be sitting at his right hand and left. Because to be, as you were saying, to be where he was, to live as he lived, they didn't really know what that meant. And they would. And, you know, the tradition of all the apostles is all but one died a violent death. So they, you know, when it came down to it, and he would warn them, John 14 in particular, 14, 15, and in the 16, I guess, that they would be facing some persecution. So that they would know that it was coming. And when he ascended into heaven and they began teaching, they got to see it up close and personal. You know, James was killed very early on. Peter was next, Acts 12. So they got to see the reality of it. And as far as we know, what any record shows, they were all faithful. But they were willing, they did count that cost. They didn't understand it here, what that meant. Okay, how can we show the same pattern of humility in our lives today? And what are some other New Testament passages that exhort us to do that. So first of all, how can we do that?
Serve others.
Let's be specific. We're being too generic here. Serve. Yeah, but what does that mean? Okay.
Having the same love, being of one accord, of one mind.
Okay. Read verses 3 and 4.
Let nothing be done through selfish ambition or conceit, but in lowliness of mind, let each esteem others better than himself. Let each of you look out not only for his own interest, but also for the interest of others.
And how many ways can those situations arise where we could do that with our brethren, to set aside our own desires, think of their ways more than our own? How many different ways can we do that? Derek?
Yeah, Stephen, I think the point of Jesus pulling out a child is that it was someone that could not bring them any sort of physical reward. I mean, the child wasn't going to have the political influence or be able to repay you for your kindness or anything like that. It's about helping those who couldn't give those things back to you.
Yeah. And who are they trying to please? The children. More than anybody. Generally speaking, who are children trying to please more than anybody?
Their parents.
Their parents, right? And so us being children of God, who should we be trying to please more than anybody? Our Father. And in that way, in that innocence, we're not worried about anybody else, as you said, no political influences there, not looking for any reward out of it. And that's something we have to think about as Christians. Are we in it just for the reward, or are we doing it because we love God? Now, it sounds like a semantics, because we're going to get a reward if we're following God, but why are we in it? Okay.
I mean, there's so many things there. It's love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, goodness, faithfulness, gentleness, self-control. Against such things, there is no law. When we work on these things, we are going to be pleasing to our Father, and we will be serving others.
Okay. But Michael?
To go along with that, almost the entire sixth chapter of Galatians is devoted to talking about helping each other.
Okay.
Especially mentions in the chapter, let's do good to everyone, especially those with houses of faith.
Right.
So we're explicitly called to help out each other.
Okay. You're right.
Then the Beatitudes, when we read those, to try to mold our character.
Okay. The Beatitudes, Matthew 5, 4 through 8, or actually 4 through about 12, I guess. What about 1 Corinthians 13, 4 through 8, talking about love? One of the descriptions of love does not boast. Not, in other words, you're not thinking about self. Does not seek its own. If you're not seeking your own, what are you seeking? Whose are you seeking? Somebody else's, right?
And does not take into account
right.
That's a
yeah, you know, basically it means you're not keeping an account here. When somebody does something wrong, you don't have this little book over here about all the things that somebody did wrong to you. That's a big difference. I mean, love is what it comes down to, isn't it? It's going to be the motivating factor behind what we do. If you don't love somebody, are you going to humble yourself in front of them? Probably not. And if you did, it probably wouldn't be sincere. Probably have some ulterior motive in it. So it's pretty important. Okay, any other passages? Okay, go ahead.
Likewise, you younger people, submit yourself to your elders. Yes, all of you, be submissive to one another and be close with the
other. That's a good one. You know, sometimes we just read the first part of that, of you younger, be submissive to the elder, but in the end he says, be submissive to one, all of you, be submissive to one another. What kind of attitude, what kind of atmosphere are we going to have in the church if that is truly going on? Okay. You know, that's going to be the primary thing, right? We're there to serve God. Peace, right? Because if you're willing to defer to somebody else on things that just don't matter, no conflict, right? I've heard stories over the years about silly conflicts that brethren get into. And one of the, I don't know what the right word is, ridiculous ones I've ever heard. The congregation, I'll refrain from saying where it was at, but they were redoing their building, and they taking out all the carpet, painting the walls. I mean, they were doing everything. And it literally got down to a fight over what color of the carpet. And because there were two people that would not cede to the other, the church, the entire church, ended up dividing. Now, that's how silly we can get. And over something that, did that really matter? The color of the carpet? But it happens. And I wish I could say I was making that story up, but I know the congregation. And it's sad when you've got that going on. I've been in a congregation before, part of a congregation, where the building itself, when you come in the main auditorium, it had a center aisle and two rows or two columns of seats on one on each side. And you could come into class on a Wednesday night and you could literally see the division of one side or the other, because somebody would say something, the other one always had to say something to refute it or add their 2 cents worth in, and it was just a constant back and forth. That congregation doesn't exist anymore because it shouldn't. And that's sad to say, but if we're coming together just to fight with one another, are we helping each other out? And it all goes back to this idea of humility that Jesus is trying to get across here to his disciples. And this isn't the only time that he teaches this and shows it. Because humility will go a long way in accomplishing a lot of things within the Lord's church. If you think about the Corinthian church, someone brought up the Corinthian church. How much trouble did they have?
A lot.
How much good do you think they were doing at that time? I don't get the idea anywhere in Paul's letters there that they were doing any actual work. They had so much trouble going on in their congregation, they had to deal with that first and get it corrected. And that's what will happen. If you've got a church that's fighting amongst itself, it's probably not going to be doing any work because they're spending all their efforts fighting with each other. And it usually comes down to the matter of humility, which is based on the idea of love. If you've got love for your brethren, humility comes very easily. And so it's something we have to constantly work on. Okay, what is Jesus ultimately saying that we must do if we desire greatness? Be a servant, right? Instead of looking for a high position, look for the low position. Because when we exalt ourselves, what does God do? He humbles us. But if we humble ourselves, he will exalt us. So we've got to get the right order there. We get it mixed up, our life's probably going to be mixed up. Okay, any other comments, questions on this section? All right. Now, the contrast in the same person, the Jesus the servant, is Jesus the supreme master overall. And let's look at a few points of his life here to show how he had authority and exhibited or demonstrated, some people might say exuded authority, but I think that, I don't know if that's the right word or not, but he certainly showed it in his life that so that others recognized it. How did he show his, what the word I'm looking for is, his role of master in calling the disciples? Okay. Who's going to be able to do that?
Well, not only did he say, come follow me, but on a couple of occasions, he said, come follow me, and then provided for their families by catching fish.
Okay.
Filled their nets with fish. They got provisions for a long time, and now they can go follow.
Now, who are you going to leave all to go follow? Just anybody? And I think we talked about this when we were looking at Matthew, the fact that he said, follow me, and they followed him, left all. They must have had some knowledge of him prior to this that would allow them to trust him to know that they would be okay. And as you said, their families. Because some of these had families that they still had to take care of. You know, Peter was married. Whether he had kids or not, we're not told, but he was married, so he had responsibilities. Okay? What about over the spirits? How did he show his role of master there? And over the spirits?
First off, he talked to them.
Okay, talked to them.
So, who else do we know that talks to spirits?
Okay.
And the orders and they follow him. I mean, that's pretty telling. You know, if you can talk to the spirits, give them orders and they follow you, we're doing something different here, folks.
You know, I think the text we're going to look at on the next page here, I think, you know, the people saw that.
Yeah, that's what I mean.
Yeah.
Folks saw that and went,
You know, they're saying, who is this man that he commands the spirits and they obey him? It would be, if I commanded a spirit, that'd be odd, I guess, but they're not going to listen to me.
It would be odd if you could even get the spirit to respond to you.
Right. And for them to obey, we know he's got power over the spirits. Richard? So, to me, that's a good demonstration of his position as master over them. Okay, what about matters over the old law? Okay. Okay. So what did he mean by saying he was Lord over the Sabbath? Lord, right, by making the claim, he's saying that I'm master in some way, but what master over the Sabbath? How so?
It's a holy day.
Okay.
So whose? That's my day.
Okay. What's that? He is.
I think he's also kind of indicating that by what he's doing, the Sabbath will no longer be valid. That makes
I think probably in the long run true, but I don't know if that's what he's telling them. Because to them, they're only interested in right now, you're breaking, that's what they were saying, you're breaking the Sabbath by going out and taking grain. But by him pointing back to David, and the example that he gave there was he ate some of the showbread. Was it wrong to eat the showbread? Yeah, it was. So why wasn't he condemned? Again, is the law, who's the law for? For us. But is there no mercy in there anywhere? David was hungry, his men were hungry. As God said, no, you're just going to have to starve to death because the law is the law. And part of this, the problem with the Pharisees here was, yes, you couldn't work on the Sabbath. But who defined, in this case, what work was?
In this case, Jesus gets to define it as his.
Well, the Pharisees were trying to by saying that he was wrong. Remember on the Sabbath day, the phrase, the Sabbath day's journey? Where'd that come from? From man. They took God's law and they defined it how they wanted to. And this same here. They're saying you're working by getting food to eat.
Well, he took the experts and tied up
the knot. He did. Well, and part of it was because they would go to their traditions more than they would go to the law itself. And again, it wasn't that there wasn't a law that said don't work on the Sabbath. That was true. But how they took it, they took it further than what it actually said and tried to bind that as sin,
you know,
or not.
I think sometimes, especially then, these people don't make a distinction, in this case that you're talking about, of working. Mm-hmm. When you go to work, what are you doing? You're trying to gain finance. Mm-hmm. That's not survival.
Yep.
They're not making the distinction in David's case between, like you said, between survival and work.
I think they even made it tougher because I remember one occasion, I think it's Luke 14, when Jesus healed the man on the Sabbath, they complained. And he asked, would you not even loose your donkey?
Right. Survival. Would you not let your donkey go graze so that he can survive and drink and, you know, make it for the long run?
And so that's why I say they think they made it tougher even than big distinctions. They got down to counting hairs, I guess you could say. Yeah. And so no one could really live up to their standard. But I think more than all these things, this reminds me of the Sermon on the Mount when Jesus would say, you've heard it said, but I say to you. To me, when I hear Jesus say he is the Lord of the Sabbath, in effect, he's saying, I can rightly determine what is sin and what is not. And I imagine for those ones who were criticizing him and his disciples, that was not what they wanted to hear. Because they had determined themselves as the one who would say what was right and what wasn't.
I mean, you're talking about Sabbath day journey. So were they told they couldn't get up and go take a walk on the Sabbath day?
They had it down to the number of steps you could take.
But Jesus is saying, I can defy if I want to get up and go take a walk, or if y'all want to get up and just go take a walk, you know?
Well, I think he was, in this case, rightly saying he was the one who could rightly determine that. Who was he? He was the Son of God. Did he know the law? I'm pretty sure he did.
What he's saying is he can look in a person's heart and figure out whether what you're doing is by your own standards of work, or if you're just...
He could do it for everybody.
Right.
Richard?
Mm-hmm. Apart from him was not anything made that was made. And it goes back over to Genesis, the seventh day, God rested.
Mm-hmm.
To create everything. It was God's plan, but Jesus carried it out. He made it. He made the Sabbath.
And again, as we get it backwards of, is this just for keeping the law? Because that's what the Pharisees were interested in, just keeping the law. But what was the purpose of it? That's what Jesus always got to. You know, okay, here's what the law says, and they just say, okay, that's what it says, you can't do this. But Jesus really got to, what does the law mean? What was its purpose? And unless we do that, we're probably missing out on what these commands for us are today. Why are these things given to us? You know, when we think about something that we all know, baptism, okay, we know what the command is, but why? And when we better understand why we do these things, then it'll be more meaningful to us. And when we go out and try to teach others, we will be better able to explain what it's all about. Because if you look at the way the world looks at, why is dunking somebody completely underwater do any good? To them, it's nothing. It's foolish, as you said. I mean, that's silly. It's like some superstition or some tradition that really has no place. But when we understand what it's really all about, then we can explain to them why it should make sense. And Jesus... Right. But if we just say, well, just because it says so, then we're really not making good argument as to why they need to do it. Okay, next one, over nature. How did he show his mastership, his position as master there? Pretty powerful, right? I would be there right along with the disciples being amazed at, you know, kind of like when he did with casting out the demons, commanding them to go away, and people saying, who is this that he commands the spirits and they obey him? And now when he does this, I would be right along with the disciples thinking, who is this that he commands the wind and the waves?
Mm-hmm.
Yep. Okay, what about at the temple in chapter 11? Fashioning the whip and driving them out. Could just anybody have done that? If you think about all the money changers in the temple, Why would they even pay attention to him? I guess I asked for that one. Okay, beyond the whip. But
it was acting with authority.
Okay. Yeah, and I think they saw that too. And again, this isn't early in his ministry. This is late in his ministry. And they've probably seen him many times, heard of him, knew his reputation, knew that this wasn't just anybody coming in here to do this. And right along with what he said, you know, you've made my house a den of thieves. Now, he's saying this, quoting from the Old Testament, what something that God said, but by him saying it, what was he really saying?
I am God.
He is. And he had, if that was God, then he had the authority to do that.
And that's interesting. In the first claim that he said, my father's house is in the thing.
Yep.
Now he's saying, my house
right.
is a house of prayer for all
right.
nations.
Yeah. And that's something we could kind of glide over if we don't think about what he's saying there. But I think he is making that equation. But whether they realized it or not, they did see that he came in with authority and they got out of there. But in all these things, now you think about all these things that Jesus demonstrated that he was master over these things and being able to talk to men and display or demonstrate authority that people saw it and they listened to him. The fact that he commanded the spirits and demons and they listened to him. The fact that he could rightly determine what the law says and its true meaning, nature itself, wind, waves, and then going into the house of God. Put all these things together. Is there anything then that we could say that he didn't have power over?
Yes, he didn't have power over. He didn't have power over your ability to make choices.
Okay. Well, I would disagree with you. He has the power, but does he exercise it? No. But if we see that he has power over all these things, then what should that say about how we should view him?
We should be glad to submit to that Lord.
And not just out of terror, but seeing him for who he truly is. Because if we're talking about the entire universe, and as you made reference to in Genesis 1 and John 1, he created all things, then we see his place in the universe, and we see his power, and you think about all that power, and yet we're still here. Because we've all transgressed his will, and yet we're still here. What should that say about him? How should we view him then? Merciful master. He's not a slave driver who's oppressing us and making our lives miserable, but he's a master who has provided our every need. So how's this side of Jesus more in line with what was expected of the Christ? What were the Jews of the first century looking for? Yeah, kind of a super person. And with this side of him, with all the power, the miracles, the teaching, driving out, only problem was he didn't use it in the way they thought. So we'll talk more about that next week. We'll pick up with page 21 next week. Appreciate all your comments.